I hope that let me make something clear. When Dr. Asabak is saying that you know, women end up with these pregnancies and they have to deliver these children with massive birth defects, and it exposes them to a high risk because delivering these babies is not easy. Basically, what he's saying is that even if you do ultrasound in Iraq and if you see birth defects, law does not allow them to have an abortion. So you must carry the baby and you must deliver it, and it creates a very difficult situation for doctors because they are putting everybody in a huge way of harm. But that is the law and they cannot do anything about it. So this is a poster that Michigan made for our talk, and you know, I would like to talk about this public health, you know, what is our responsibility as not just public health researchers, because this here probably most people are engineers or something else, I don't know. This is MIT after all, so I'm thinking they are engineers. So I'm going to try to do this right. So what Dr. Al-Sabak is presented to you is like what happened in Iraq immediately after which you see these kinds of birth defects skyrocketing. Massive disruption of the environment, that's what happened. A huge, huge invasion and the use of incredible amounts of ammunition. And so it was not, this stuff is not being seen in a vacuum. It's seen right after the environment was hugely disrupted. So let me, with that, go to my next slide. Is it working? Ah, let's go back because I want to show you this one. All right, so what are some sources of environmental pollution that could contribute to potentially seeing these kinds of things? Bullets, bombs, explosives containing various metals like titanium, magnesium, lead, mercury. These are all things, that metals that the weapons industry love and they use all the time. Military bases and is another source of heavy pollution, and their junkyards. Dr. Al-Sabak only showed you a few pictures of junkyards, but all around Iraq, around big towns or small towns where U.S. military bases are located, there are huge, huge waste sites, you know, junkyards containing thousands, and I mean thousands. I'm not exaggerating. If you go to YouTube and you look at junkyards Iraq, you will see several footages that U.S. military personnel have made. Thousands of these things. Some of them you don't know what the instrument is. It's just this gigantic, enormous metal thing. And so they sit and slowly rot. I don't know, just weather. And the stuff that's used in building these things are definitely getting released into the environment. Has anybody heard about open-air burn pits? Anybody here has heard about it? We'll talk about this. Well, one very interesting statistics I have in red in the bottom of this slide. Between 2002 and 2005, U.S. armed forces expended 6 billion bullets. 6 billion bullets. That is 300 bullets per individual they killed in Iraq. Sometimes I think to myself, if you just sieve the soil, you will get these pellets, you know. So it's pretty, I find it quite difficult to believe. But oops, I'm going the wrong way. So everybody is really concerned about how much depleted uranium was used. Is it something that's involved in this stuff? And this is the statistics we have from UNEP, that in 2007 the publication came out, and it estimates that between 1,000 and 2,000 metric tons of depleted uranium was fired during the 2003 war in Iraq. Right after that, I guess there is no other estimate. I will tell this now. We haven't seen high levels of uranium in any of the tissue samples we have examined. We have looked at hair, toenail, tooth, and of children from Iraq, and we haven't been able to see high levels of uranium. If the levels of uranium are not high enough, you cannot do ratio analysis to determine if it's depleted or not. So we're going to have to go with what we have right now. So why am I making such a... Yes. So the most intense exposure to these various compounds is done through your breathing. So when a bomb explodes, whatever is in that bomb, because it has very high temperature, it's converted into nanoparticles, and these nanoparticles are sucked in by just people who breathe the air there, and lots of it enters your body, and of course your lungs are very expanded tissue, and they easily suck in all of these pollutants, and at that time you're exposed to the highest amount of all the pollutants that are there. Once the dust settles, the stuff goes into the soil, but stays there. They're highly stable. They stay there and they keep circulating in your environment, and you're continuously, chronically being exposed to them. So a little bit about open-air burn pits. Apparently, on every U.S. military base, there had been these burn pits in which they burned plastics, batteries, you name it, all kinds of stuff. And some of these burn pits have apparently been quite large, the size of a football field. And they continuously burned from 2003 to 2010, when their use was deemed illegal, and they stopped burning things in these pits. Now, it didn't just happen they stopped it. There have been so much complaints and so many complications of health on U.S. military soldiers. They would be returning and they would just, you know, have all kinds of diseases. And so it eventually was stopped. I have a few pictures of these burn pits. Here's one right outside of Baghdad. Again, another one right outside of Baghdad. This one is in Afghanistan, if it shows up, yes. Huge, huge, gigantic size burn pits. And they burned everything in them. So where would these things be located? Here is a map of locations of U.S. military bases in Iraq. This is only a handful of them. At the height of U.S. military invasion and occupation of Iraq, there were over 500 military bases in Iraq. As you can see, major Iraqi cities are virtually surrounded by them. Now imagine these burn pits burning day in and day out for 7 years straight. Whoever is living in these towns is chronically and highly exposed to these very toxic pollutants all the time. Now imagine if it is a pregnant mother who's being exposed to these exhausts, at the same time being exposed to the pollution that comes from the bombing. It's quite a scary scenario. So we have samples, we have analyzed samples from Basra, from Fallujah, and from Hawija more recently. I think you can see it on the map. So what happened after, because so many U.S. military soldiers had been returning with massive problems, all kinds of cancers and lung problems and emphysema and all kinds of obstructive pulmonary diseases, things like that, finally the Institute of Medicine did a study, quite an extensive study, and it was released in 2011. They looked at air monitoring, air samples of U.S. military bases. One major one is called Joint Base Balat. It's outside of Baghdad. It's quite large. It's one of the largest U.S. military bases. And in the air sample, they found all of these compounds, volatile organics, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, all of these things. And the conclusion of their report, or the report that they published, is called Long-Term Health Consequences of Exposure to Burn Pits in Iraq and Afghanistan. They basically concluded that cumulative exposure to mixtures of chemicals by inhalation could lead to health complications and health damage to the soldiers, to U.S. soldiers. Now, U.S. soldiers are kind of in their 30s or 20s, or, you know, they're adults. And imagine if this damages an adult, what it will do to a growing child or a mother who's pregnant. We know for a fact that pregnant mothers and growing children and fetuses are much more susceptible to exposure to pollutants than an adult person would be. But of course, that's not a concern of this research, although it should have been, because all of these people are public health advocates. So there was another follow-up, a review of the same thing, and they basically reiterated the same thing, that potential health effects associated with exposure to these emissions could be these things, neurological effects and reduced central nerves. All of these things that they enumerated are things that that Iraqi doctors routinely grapple with. People in Iraq are showing these effects. They are getting sick with these things all the time. So what else happened? Very recently, last year, the Department of Veterans Affairs set up a registry for U.S. veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, which means if you had been working in one of these military bases in Iraq or Afghanistan and you are sick, and you have gone to the doctor, and you have been exposed to the emissions from these pits, you can register, you can go to the registry and register. It will provide you with certain amount of protection or help, or, you know, in terms of your health. They will cover some more of your expenses. It's in a way acknowledging that exposure to pollutants that were created by war caused harm to your health. What else happened? Eventually, after a lot of struggle by U.S. military personnel, Halliburton and KBR, who were in charge of disposing waste, and they chose to burn them that way, finally, the courts decided that they are not immune to they can be sued, basically. And very recently, the federal court allows that lawsuits be, you know, brought about, and I think thousands of people are now thinking of suing Halliburton for damage to their health. So what are some of the, before I go into showing you exposure data that we have, what are the things that we know? Scientifically, it is known to us. We know that prenatal exposure to metals during in utero development can cause brain damage in a developing fetus. We know that. Fetal brain damage can result from metal exposure levels, which are much lower than those affecting adult brain and its normal function. A lot lower levels can harm badly a growing fetus. Increasing evidence suggests that chemicals can also be the cause of neurodevelopmental damage in the unborn. So we've published a couple of papers. This is the two of them, one in 2011, one in 2012. One other one, which is about Hawija, will be coming out in a couple of weeks. So what did we find in these? Our paper about Fallujah, we looked at reproductive history of about 80 families in Fallujah, and four of them were specifically more intriguing because we could look back into time to assess the reproductive health of the family, because there is a husband with two wives, as you can see. And you can see the first case. You can actually draw a line where 2003 happened and bombardment of Fallujah happened. Right after that, you see all kinds of complications of birth. The same case again in the bottom. So it's quite clear that birth defects and issues with birth really emerge immediately after 2003 in Fallujah. Here's another family, a husband with two wives. And what you can see here is the first wife started had a malformed child in 2008, and her young daughter had a child that had birth defects. And the second wife seems to be having quite a difficult time having normal babies. So the idea is these kinds of scenarios would have been completely, difficult to believe that something like this would happen if the environment has not been disrupted. This is very unusual happening in terms of like transgenerational effect of pollution, of birth. These families have never had any problems in the past until these kinds of things started happening after 2003. In Fallujah, we showed increases in birth defects and increases in miscarriages. And as Dr. Sabak was showing you, we also see severe birth defects, most of which seem to be folate dependent. Here is some exposure data. This slide shows you lead and mercury in children of Fallujah with birth defect, comparing them with children in other areas where there has not been as much there hasn't been bombardments, or so there's quite high levels of lead and mercury in Fallujah babies. At that time, we didn't measure titanium because I had no reason to look for titanium. Recently, there was a paper that was published by Dr. Zima from Stony Brook, and in his paper, he found high levels of titanium and magnesium, weapons manufacturing metals, in his patients' lungs. These are soldiers who lived on U.S. military bases. So when I found that out, then I looked for titanium. Now I wish I had more samples from Fallujah to look for that as well. But unfortunately, there is no more samples that we have from Fallujah. And Fallujah right now is under so much bombardment and so much horrific, really, situation. And everybody has escaped the town. It's really hard to even contact my colleague, Dr. Al-Ani, who was supposed to be here, but because of the war, she wasn't able to come. I haven't heard from him for over 2 weeks. She's a refugee herself. So our third paper, we looked at very similar data we have for Basra. Lead and mercury high in hair sample of children from Basra. Our third paper is we collected samples in Hawija. Hawija is about maybe a half an hour north of Fallujah, maybe an hour north of Fallujah. It's a tiny city of about 40,000 people. And in 2003, U.S. Invaders, they took over a school and converted it into a military base. After that, doctors in Hawija have been witnessing an increase in neurodevelopmental disorders, like cerebral palsy, conditions like that. And they were wondering what is happening to them. Most all of these things people blame on the U.S. invasion and pollution created by them. So they sent us some samples, and we tried to look for the same thing, see if there's metals that we can detect. This study is going to come out in environmental monitoring and assessment within a week and a half, I hope. Here is some pictures of the children of Hawija. It is very hard to get people to give consent and participate in any kind of study. They really trust nobody. But we were able to get seven or eight families to help us with sampling of their children. So what we found is this. Large amounts of titanium and magnesium in children of Hawija. Khorramshahr is a city adjacent to Iraq, but in Iran. I collected the hair samples from Khorramshahr, from Iran, and we looked to see how different they may be. And as you can see, there's quite a huge amount of both of these metals in their hair samples. This is more metals, different kinds of metal, cadmium, arsenic, and lead in hair samples of children in Hawija. Here I'm comparing it to children from Hawija who are not disabled. The physicians there insisted that I don't say normal because they don't know if these children grow and become older, will they still appear to have no problems. They said, so they don't appear to be disabled, but we cannot say that they're normal because they're growing and they might develop things. So again, pretty high levels of all these metals. We did another small study in Basra. We looked at deciduous tooth. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but deciduous teeth of children they are constructed prenatally. So whatever exposure the mother had to any pollutants, specifically metals, you would be able to see it in the deciduous tooth. After it falls, you can analyze the tooth. This is a technique called laser ablation. You can actually make maps of the tooth. Areas where there is high, really dark red, it is high levels of the metal. And as it goes to colder color, more blue, it becomes colder, less lead. You can do this assessment for all metals, including uranium, arsenic, anything, and everything. We haven't been able to produce much good results for uranium, as I said. So it appears that there's no uranium in the tooth samples. But I think it is a glitch in the technique, and we might be able to perfect it and be able to see uranium. But anyway, what this is showing you is that children in Basra have three times more lead in their deciduous tooth compared to children in Iran, in Isfahan, where I was born. And twice as much as children who are growing, who grew up in Beirut, Lebanon. So again, high exposure to lead is a serious thing. Now, lead is a horrific neurotoxin compound. It's no less than uranium. I think everybody is just crazy about, oh, where is the uranium? But lead is even more toxic to nervous system of children. So what we hope to do with this is to hopefully develop it to a point where we can distinguish between the time of birth, because once a child is born, the diet changes and you see a tiny line called neonatal line form on the tooth, and you can easily tell before birth how much metal the child was the baby was exposed to as opposed to after birth. And this will give you a very good tool. NIH is very interested in ability of measuring these things accurately, and this has a potential to be developed into a tool like that. Hopefully we're able to do it, and hopefully we can do more than that. In summary, we know that public exposure to high levels of persistent toxic metals in Fallujah, Basra, and Hawija has occurred. We have exposure data to show that. Children exposure to high levels of titanium and magnesium links Iraqi public exposure to same contaminants found in sick Iraqi soldiers, U.S. soldiers. So while we know that U.S. military personnel have been exposed, we know that the public in Iraq has been exposed to the same things. We know cumulative multiple exposure to neurotoxic compounds causes developmental disorders, birth defects, brain and nervous system disorders. These are the things that the literature fully supports, and we know these things. A couple of last slides. We also know that our research has had a global impact. The European Parliament did talk about our research in 2012. They actually have the title of our paper up there, and it's in their agenda item. I hope they said, you know, useful stuff. We never saw any return on that. Following that, there was lots of discussion inside Iraq about members of the parliament describing the situation. Now, I want you to know that there had been many, many protests in Fallujah. People would be coming out and protesting and saying something is happening, birth defects are, you know, way too much out of reach. Somebody has to do something about it. But I think our research also helped that momentum be created. Eventually, in Iraq, there were discussions, and eventually lawmakers in Iraq decided some study has to be done. We have to do something about it. So Iraqi Ministry of Health got together with World Health Organization, and they did a study, and the results of that study came out last October in a report that was anonymous. Nobody had signed the report. You didn't know which office of WHO or Iraqi Minister of Health you have to contact if you have questions about the report. And so many people read that, and these are the critics, the criticisms of that report. If you know anything about epidemiology, you know that if you are selecting if there is a selection bias in selecting people you are going to study, you already will not have an accurate assessment of the situation. So WHO study relies primarily on mother's memory when they do this study. Little information about sampling methods is provided in this study. And districts that were chosen for analysis, a lot of people feel that may not have been representative of the entire governorate as a whole. Misclassifications, measurement errors, and overall selection bias, these are quite deadly to a report, and makes something that is suspect to have not done these things right, the results of it could easily be discarded. So this joint work with the WHO and the Iraqi Minister of Health really didn't help much, because it created more problems than it solved. What are we trying to do? We're trying to bring this story out to more American publics, especially young people, and try to develop collaborations, hopefully expand our research, and also find ways of prevention. I think the One, the first thing that should be done is a cleanup of U.S. military bases. I don't know, you guys are all very young, but if you remember, those of you who do, in Vietnam, the United States left a horrific legacy of pollution. To this day, Vietnamese children are being born, cancers are high, birth defects are high. So by no means, this scenario we see in Iraq is an isolated event. It's something we have seen repeatedly in Vietnam, in Korea, in the Philippines. Dirty bases of the United States all over the world is polluting what they are the most notorious polluter of the earth. And we should know that, and we should try to think about how we can make a difference in things. We're going to go to all of these places, hopefully talk to them about the same things. Maybe we can inspire people to act, to do something. Here is some flyers that some universities have made for us. I have a thank you slide I will show you. But this is basically all the universities that have helped us come together and conduct this tour. This is a slide I've never shown anywhere, but I will show you guys. this is really peculiar. They have all these maps and they continue to throw bombs. And they don't even know what they're dropping where. Here's another slide I want to share with you guys. This tells you how intimately Department of Defense is integrated in our institutes of higher learning. This is something that we should all know and think about, and see how it is that we can stop helping them, because their main goal is to develop the military and more sophisticated ways to fully destroy things. So we need to think about who we are lending our brains to. I think effectively right now U.S. universities are like a place for these big money places like the Department of Defense to rent us to use our brains for themselves. And what they end up giving us is horrific situations like in Iraq right now. So I think probably this one you all have seen about the military expenditure. Again, very, very disturbing. So with that, please, if you have any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them. Thank you.